Well, I'm just going to get out of the way, and first let's just bring up Alex for, we're going to go three in a row, and then I'm going to ask a few questions, and then you'll have a chance. So, Alex.
Thank you. Do I have a pointer? If I can just gesticulate.
Sure, it's okay. Probably
going to
show up a little clearer.
Okay, sure. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. It's a pleasure to be able to share my views on this important issue with you all. So the title of my talk is Executive Compensation, What's Right and What Could Be Fixed. So what I hope to do in my 15 minutes is give you some perspectives of both sides of the compensation debate. And this policy piece is joint work with Xavier Gabex of the NYU Stern School of Business, who's also my co-author on a lot of the academic research which underpins what I'm about to say. So as was mentioned in the introduction, executive compensation is a highly controversial topic. So there's a very influential view that what we see in reality is inefficient. So in theory, what should happen is that the board of directors should set pay on behalf of shareholders to maximize shareholder value. But maybe what happens in practice is executives get away with paying themselves as much as they can get away with. And there are many examples of this taking place, which has led to this view. So no one really complains if CEOs get paid well if they've added a lot of value to the firm. But we've seen a number of examples where CEOs are well paid even when the firm performance is nothing to do with their own actions. So perhaps you have an oil firm which delivers high profits not because of the CEO's cost-cutting strategy, but because there happens to be an oil crisis. And on the flip side, you may have examples of where the CEO destroys a lot of value but still walks away with a lot of severance pay or some high guaranteed bonuses. So not surprisingly, in the light of a few of these examples, this has led to policymakers and others calling for reforms for executive compensation. So perhaps having pay caps and other legislation to try to limit what is seen as excessive compensation. But this is not the only interpretation of what we see in reality. So there's another side which argues that actually many features of executive compensation are not inconsistent with market forces, and particularly when you think about the other roles of a compensation structure, such as to attract talented managers and motivate them to innovate products and to come up with good strategies. So that's why I have just a quote from the Hippocratic Oath here, first, do no harm. So perhaps the role of a policymaker is similar to the role of a doctor or a physician. So if there are problems, then we have to fix them, but we don't want to implement a fix if there's actually no problem to begin with. And one example which is sometimes given is the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which was written a few years ago. So in response to some of the corporate scandals a couple of years ago, the Sarbanes-Oxley disclosure regulations were implemented. And this, some critics argue, may have done some more harm than good by increasing the disclosure requirements. This has led other firms to be listing, say, outside the US. So this is perhaps where the role of academic research comes into this. So you might think, well, why do academics even have a say in this debate? Isn't this a real-world question that should be answered by compensation consultants or shareholders or pension funds and large institutional investors? What do we, sat in our ivory towers, have to add to this debate? Well, there's a number of things that we can add. So what the media may focus on is a few high-profile, egregious examples of huge pay without performance. But what we want to do is to look at what happens in hundreds of companies, study hundreds and thousands of companies in the US and perhaps around the world, to see whether these inefficiencies are just a few bad apples or whether the entire cart is rotten. And also, even if the practices which are documented in the media are widespread, is this necessarily a sign of inefficiency, or can this be consistent with market forces and optimality when we think about the other features, so the other roles of a compensation scheme, such as attracting and motivating talented managers. So there are various features of compensation which are looked at both in the media and by academics and policymakers, and Bob Frank later is going to talk about the level of pay, which is just the sheer fact that CEOs get paid far more than the average worker, which was referred to in the introduction. So rather than covering that ground, I'm going to focus on a different topic, which is the sensitivity of pay for performance. So rather than the actual level, does pay actually go up with good performance, and do CEOs get punished for poor performance? A And on the face of it, it seems that there's no real punishment for poor performance because CEOs seem to get guaranteed bonuses. So bonuses should be performance contingent, but in fact, often when CEOs and even lower level employees are appointed, they're given bonuses which are guaranteed regardless of what performance happens to be. And moreover, there's often severance pay and golden parachutes, so even if the CEO does so badly that he or she ends up being fired, they can walk away with a rather large packet. And so what some people can look at is the sensitivity of salary and bonuses and also new grants of stock and options to the firm's stock price or to other measures such as the firm's revenues or accounting profits. And typically this is seen to be very, very low. Therefore, there's no sensitivity of pay to performance. But in fact, to look at this issue deeper, what you need to take into account is the fact that most of the CEO's incentives stem not so much from the salary and bonuses that they're getting, but the sensitivity of their existing portfolio of stock and options. So while CEOs may get, say, broad brush, $10 million a year, a lot of CEOs also have, say, hundreds of millions of dollars of previously granted stock and options. So even though Steve Jobs of Apple only gets $1 of salary per year, regardless of what the performance is, this doesn't mean he doesn't care about the performance of Apple. By contrast, he has so much of his own wealth tied up in the stock and options of Apple that he gets a large payout if the firm does well and consequently is punished if the firm does badly. However, even when we take into account all of these previously granted shares and options, it's not clear that CEOs are paid for performance. So there's a very influential study by Professor Mike Jensen of Harvard Business School and Kevin Murphy of the University of Southern California in 1990 who looked at all sources of a CEO's incentives, salary, bonuses, shares, and also the probability of being fired. And even under their most aggressive estimates, they found that CEOs only lose $3.25 for every $1,000 loss of shareholder value. So this seems just very, very low. This is effectively a 0.3% stake in the firm, not an incentive to avoid poor performance. However, again, looking at this issue more deeply, it's not clear that the relevant measure of incentives is the dollar change in the CEO's wealth for a dollar change in firm performance. Yes, it's true if the CEO did something to improve firm value by $1,000, he wouldn't get much out of it. He gets $3.25. But but most CEOs' actions will have a much greater impact on firm value than just $1,000. In fact, many CEO actions we can see as having a multiplicative, a percentage effect on firm value, rather than a fixed dollar amount of firm value. For example, if you think of a CEO designing a new way to organize production, this can be rolled out across an entire firm, and so it has a larger effect in a larger firm. So when we think of ideas such as innovation or cost cutting or changing strategies, it's quite plausible to think that these have a percentage effect on firm value rather than a dollar effect on firm value. And therefore, one other measure of incentives is the dollar change in CEO wealth for a percentage change in firm value. And this is indeed you can get quite different conclusions. So a recent survey paper by Carola Friedman of MIT Sloan and Dirk Genter of Stanford University found that CEOs lose $284,000 for a 1% loss in shareholder value. So this is where just by thinking more deeply as to what the effect of CEOs' actions are, we get very different conclusions as to whether CEOs are paid like bureaucrats or in fact are paid for performance. Okay, so that was the first half of the debate. I said I was going to try and present both sides. So this is the view that certain features of compensation may not necessarily be inefficient when we measure it in a different way, taking into account previously granted stock and options, and also interpreting it differently, seeing that CEOs have percentage effects on firm value. But now I want to go to the flip side, which is the what could be fixed part of my talk. Is that I'm not going to claim or even attempt to claim that everything about compensation is optimal. There's certainly a number of areas for improvement. I believe both Jesse and Bob are going to talk about some suggestions. I'm going to talk about something hopefully different from what they'll be mentioning. So while the level of incentives on average is not necessarily inconsistent with efficiency, it may well be the case that the level of incentives is not correct at the right time. For example, the CEOs are given stock and options to align themselves with shareholders. But what happens if we have a crisis? The stock price falls, the value of the shares and the options that the CEO has also falls, and is worth very little and has very little incentive effect precisely at the time where the company's in trouble and you want the CEO to be working hard. So just to give you an example of how options work, and I apologize to the 95% of you in the room who probably already know this, but just to make sure everybody's on the same page, the way how a stock option works, for example, if the stock price is now $40, you may give the CEO an option which makes sure that he's paid if and only if the stock price rises above $40. So if it's below that, he doesn't get anything, but if the stock price, when the option matures, is greater than that, he gets the difference. So what happens if the stock price plummets to $20? Well, this option, which pays you if and only if the stock price rises above $40, is hardly going to pay out. It's very unlikely to pay out, and it's going to have very little effect on the CEO. So one practice which is commonly used is the idea of repricing options. So what they may do is like change the rules of the game. They may say, well, let's change the option to say, now you're going to be paid if and only if the stock price goes above $20. But this is very poor in terms of incentives, right? If the CEO does badly and then you're just lowering his benchmark, this reduces his incentives to do well in the first place. It's sort of shooting an arrow and then drawing the target afterwards. So while this is a way of re-incentivizing the CEO, it's also something which doesn't really punish him for failure. So this is one thing that Xavier and I and many others see as being a problem with the current compensation regimes. The second idea is, while I've talked about the level of incentives, another important feature is the horizon of incentives. So it's not just sufficient for CEOs to be tied to shareholder value, but we need to think about, are they tied to long-term or short-term shareholder value? So one prominent example is the Countrywide CEO, Angelo Mozzillo, who sold $129 million of stock in the 12 months before the start of the housing crisis. So he was able to cash out scot-free, well, close to scot-free, and therefore he wasn't suffering when the shareholders and the employees suffered from 2007 onwards. And while this is only one example, there are many other examples, and I don't need to go beyond the title of this journal article to tell you the story. It says, before the bust, these CEOs took money off the table. They were able to cash out early, sell their stock and options, and so they departed from the ship before it started to sink. And also, Lucian Bebchuk, Jesse Fried's co-author, and Cohen and Sparman have this paper looking at top management at Bear Stearns and Lehman. So some people from the efficient camp argue that the Bear Stearns and the Lehman executives did suffer in the crisis, but what they found was they were able to actually cash out quite a lot in advance of the crisis, so they actually still did pretty well when you look over a longer time period. So in the light of these two problems, number one, incentives losing their power over time, and number two, incentives being too short term, what Xavier and I thought of is a way of changing the way that CEOs are compensated to address these issues. And when we thought about how to do this, we one of the main focuses is how to make this implementable. So often academics can come up with their brilliant ideas of how to reform something, but this is useless practically if there's no way to implement it in a simple manner. So what we wanted to do was to retain the basic building blocks that we already have of stock, cash, deferred compensation, and just twist this to a small degree and perhaps address those two concerns that I mentioned in the last slide. And so this is an idea that we also developed with Thomas Sadzik of NYU and Yuli Sanikov of Princeton University. And the working title of this is the dynamic incentive account. So what this involves is paying the CEO with cash and stock as they are currently. But rather than paying out the cash and stock immediately, we're going to escrow this into what we're going to call an incentive account. And in this account, we're going to have, just for broad numbers, 60% of the account will be in stock, and the rest of the account is in cash. And there's going to be two key features of this account which are going to address the two problems I mentioned in the last slide. So the first principle is what we're calling the long horizon principle, is that these securities, the cash and the stock, are escrowed in the account. They cannot be withdrawn immediately, but are only vested over a long time period. So this is a way of making sure that the CEOs remain tied to long-run shareholder value rather than something short-term. So this may deter short-term actions, such as writing subprime loans and then quitting before they become delinquent. But also on the positive side, it will encourage CEOs hopefully to take long-term actions, such as investing in R&D and human capital, which only show up maybe 3 or 4 years from now. So while the CEO is given stock and options, they cannot cash out immediately. They vest over a long period, say about 5 years' time. And importantly, when the CEO retires, they do not vest immediately. So often what we see in practice is when the CEO leaves the firm, he or she is able to withdraw everything. But this gives misaligned incentives. This may encourage them to manipulate the stock price upwards, cash out and retire, and then it's the other shareholders and the successors who are carrying the can. I'm told that I'm done, so I'm just going to go to the final point and skip the final slide. The second main principle is what we're calling the constant percentage principle, which is the idea of rebalancing the stock and cash in the account to make sure it keeps pace with the firm's changing conditions. So if what happens if the firm's stock price goes down, the value of the stock in the account goes down and has little incentive effect, as I mentioned earlier. But what we're doing is we're going to use some of the cash in the account to buy back additional stock. So we're going to be rebalancing the cash and the stock in the account so that all times 60% of the account is invested in stock. So this makes sure that the executive is reloaded after the stock price drops. But importantly, this reloading is not for free. It's not like the repricing of options, where you're giving the CEO a freebie and changing the target after the fact. Here, the additional stock that you're giving the CEO to re-incentivize and to reload him is being paid for by reducing the amount of cash in his account. So it's a way of re-incentivizing him without giving him a freebie and therefore making sure he's aligned to performance without rewarding him for failure. Okay, sorry for having gone a minute over. There's some other things which I didn't have a chance to talk through, but they'll be in the paper once it's out. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, Jesse now. You want to set up the...